Mahmani's man walked away, 10 feet, then 20, and then he turned back and raised his head and raised his arms and howled silently at the moon, his eyes screwed tight shut, his mouth wide open in a desperate snarl, his feet stamping alternately like he was running in place, all alone in the vast, empty darkness. Then he stopped and swiped his hands over his face, one after the other, and he started thinking. But the subtleties were almost completely beyond him. His friend had been killed 60 miles away by an unknown person and an unknown method with no visible signs, and then locked in the trunk of a car that could have absolutely nothing at all to do with either Rossi's boys or Safir's. Then his own rental had been taken away so that he had been forced to steal the very same car, the only possible choice in an entire town, inevitably and inexorably, like a puppet being manipulated from afar by a grinning intelligence much greater than his own. It was incomprehensible. But facts were facts. He walked back to the trunk and steeled himself to investigate further. He pushed and pulled and hauled Oscar into the center of the space and began a detailed examination, like a pathologist leaning over a mortuary table. The trunk light burned bright and hot, but it revealed nothing. Oscar had no broken bones and no bruises. His neck was intact. He had no wounds, no cuts, no scrapes, no scratches, and there was nothing under his fingernails. His gun and his knife and his money were missing, which was interesting. And all around him in the trunk were the usual kinds of things a person might expect to find in a trunk, which was odd. No attempt had been made to clean it up. No incriminating evidence had been removed. There was an empty grocery bag with a week-old register receipt inside, and a month-old local newspaper, never read and still neatly folded, and some browned and curled leaves and some crumbs of dirt, as if items had been hauled home from a plant nursery. Clearly, the car belonged to someone who used it in a fairly normal manner, and who had not prepared it in any special way for its current gruesome task. So, whose car was it? That was the first question. The license plates would reveal the answer, of course, assuming they were genuine. But there might be a faster way to find out, given the fact that nothing seemed to have been sanitized. Mahmani's man stepped away to the front passenger door and opened it, and leaned in and opened the glove box. He found a black leather wallet the size of a hardcover book, stamped on the front with the Cadillac shield in gold. Inside it, he found two instruction books, one thick, one thin, one for the car and one for the radio, and a salesman's business card clipped into four angled slots, and a registration document and an insurance document. He pulled out both documents and dropped the wallet in the footwell and held the documents close to the light inside the glove box. The car was Seth Duncan's, which was logical in a sudden, awful, spectacular way, because everything had been utterly miscalculated right from the start. There was no other possible explanation. There was no giant stranger on the rampage. No one had seen him, and no one could describe him because he didn't exist. He was an invention. He was imaginary. He was bait. He was a ruse. The whole delivery delay was bullshit. It had been staged from beginning to end. The purpose had been to lure everyone to Nebraska, to be cut out, to be eliminated, to be killed. The Duncans were removing links, severing the chain, intending to remake it with nobody between themselves at the bottom and the Saudis at the top, with a truly massive increase in profit as their prize. Audacious, but obvious and clearly feasible, clearly within their grasp, because clearly their abilities had been grotesquely underestimated by everyone. They were not the clueless rural hicks everyone thought they were. They were ruthless strategists of stunning and genuine quality, subtle, sophisticated, capable of great insight and penetrating analysis. They had foreseen Mahmani as their strongest opponent, quite correctly and accurately and realistically, and they had absolutely crippled his response from the get-go by taking Askar down, somehow, mysteriously, before the bell had even sounded, and then by leaving his untouched body in a car they knew for sure would be found and identified as one of their own. So, not just a coup, but a message, too, brazenly and artfully and subtly delivered. A message that said we can do anything we want. We can reach out and touch anyone, anywhere, anytime, and you won't even begin to understand how we did it. And in case subtlety didn't impress, they had reached out and burned Saphir's guys to death in the motel lot in a brutal demonstration of range and power. Rossi's boys hadn't done that. Rossi's boys were probably already dead themselves, somewhere else, somehow else, maybe dismembered or bled out or even crucified, or buried alive. Rossi's spokesman had used those very words on the subject of the Duncan's tastes. Mahmani's man felt completely alone. He was completely alone. He was the last survivor. He had no friends, no allies, no familiarity with the terrain, and no idea what to do next except to lash out, to fight back, to seek revenge. No desire to do anything else either. He stared through the darkness at the three Duncan houses. He closed the trunk lid on Askar, reverently, with soft pressure from eight gentle fingertips like a sad chord on a church organ. Then he walked along the dirt on the shoulder, back to the passenger door, and he leaned in and picked up his Glock from where it lay on the seat. He closed the door and skirted the hood and crossed the road and stepped onto the dirt of someone's fallow field and walked a straight line, parallel with the Duncan's fenced driveway, their three houses 100 yards ahead of him, his gun in his right hand, his knife in his left. Half a mile behind the Duncan houses, Roberto Cassano slowed and hauled the Chevrolet through a tight turn and let it coast onward toward the compound. 100 yards out, he brought it to a stop with the parking brake. He reached up and switched the dome light so it would stay off when the doors opened. He looked at Angelo Mancini next to him, and they both paused and then nodded and climbed out into the night. They drew their Colts and held them behind their backs so that the moon glinting off the shiny steel would not be visible from the front. They walked forward together, shoulder to shoulder, 100 yards to go.